So I'm currently a release engineer at Google. After 20-something years of working for startup companies, it's kind of nice to work for a company that people have actually heard of and a company that's actually shipping product that people are using. So I've been there a year, and it's been very interesting so far. Feel free. I've got time for questions. And if people have questions as I go along, we can try taking questions. If I start to run out of time or if there's too many questions, I may ask you to hold them to the end. But I'm pretty flexible on how we do that. So as I already alluded to, these commandments are from system administrators to release engineers. How many people have installed crappy software that... You didn't let me qualify that. So hopefully, the things I'm going to talk about, the ideas I'm going to talk about today will help you work with your vendors. And these commandments are solutions to requirements. They're based, and I want to talk about the requirements and how I arrived at the commandments. And it's really build and release, but that was made the title too long. Depending on where you work, release engineering means different things. At Google, it actually means, depending on what product I'm working on, it means build and release or just release. So, but what the ideas I'm going to talk about today go from the initial building to releasing, and I'll walk through those steps briefly in a moment. And this is for all software. This is for software. How many people work for a company that delivers web apps? Yeah, I do. So you know, since for the past 10 years, kind of the model's changed. You don't shrink wrap software is very rare, and lots of the apps are being delivered via the web. And so, as I said, how many people actually support machines that are running web apps? Yeah, about almost half. And so you have internal developers who have driven applications to you, and you're delivering those directly to the customers via your machines. And so hopefully some of the ideas I'm going to talk about here will help you work with your internal organization. And if it's an external vendor too, you can deliver them with requirements and say, here are the things I expect from you as a vendor, and work with them on this. And standard caveat, these ideas are mine. They're not necessarily Google's. Although I don't think Google would disagree with anything I'm saying, but they're my ideas based on my past 15 years or so of working as release engineering. My first love is systems administration. I first discovered Unix back in 1987 and been in love ever since. And so the thing I like about being a release engineer is it kind of marries. I also love software development and products. So this has actually allowed me to marry my two loves into what's really becoming a field now. Release engineering is a real job, and there's a real career path to it now. So release processes, they're usually an afterthought. Most software gets started. You have some engineers working together. They've got an idea, and their job is really to work on features and get the features into the product and get the product delivered as quickly as possible. A build process is just something they need to get the software built. I've only had one job where I was brought in at the very, very beginning of the company and actually had the luxury of architecting the release process from scratch, and that I thought it worked well, and it worked. So, but that was a luxury. Usually, you have developers, and developers may be even working in separate little groups, and then you have to marry the results of what they've done into a single process and into a single product. You know, most build systems, it just does the minimum to get it done. Because it's an afterthought, because a lot of companies don't budget developing and supporting and maintaining a build system. It just has the minimum functionality. And I'm going to talk about what a robust build system, what features it should have. And you know, the release process, it really should be treated as a product in its own right. You've got internal, when I say you, I'm talking about your vendor. Okay, these are the things that you're thinking about that your vendor should be doing. You know, you've got your own product that you're working on, but the release process is also an internal, think of it as an infrastructure tool or product. And you should treat it as that. You should have bugs against it. You should have, it's just like any other product. And that doesn't always happen. And sometimes often there's a big disconnect between the developer writing the code and sysadmin who installs it. You know, how many people have gotten software that just, it was clearly the person knew nothing about the operating system that you're running it on. Yeah, it's happening less and less, but you know, 20 years ago it was very, very common. Or it got ported from one platform to another and all they did was make sure it compiled. It's getting better, but it's still a problem. So, the steps in a build and release process, just so that you all understand the scope of what I'm talking about, because this could be like, you know, the elephant where everybody, the blind people and the elephant where, based on your view of the world, you think of builders release being something different. Well, this is my view. Since I'm giving the talk, we get to talk about my view of the world. The first step, you know, in the build and release process, assuming you've already got the product in place, here's the things it needs to do. Check out the code from the source code repository. It needs to compile and or process the code. Package the results of the build. And it needs to do analysis along each step along the way and report on the results and perform actions based on the results. If you get a build failure, what do you do? If you get a build success, you're probably going to have a different path that you're going to take. And there needs to be, not only does there need to be post-build tests, there needs to be tests along the way. You need to be running unit tests when you do compiles. You need to be running smoke tests once the build's done. You need to be running system tests. And all of that needs to be automated if possible. So what are the process features? And then I'll get into the commandments. It needs to be reproducible. And I don't have to tell you all too much about reproducibility. I think that's been a common thread in Lisa for years and years and years. You know, we want to automate. You know, you need to be able to track changes to the product and understand what's in the new version of a product or a product component. You'd be surprised at how many times you take delivery of a build or a product and you really aren't sure what has changed between this build and the previous one. There needs to be some kind of identification mechanism. I call it a build ID. Some companies call it a build label. It doesn't matter what you call it, but it needs to uniquely identify what is in the package. And I'm going to talk about that more later. And there needs to be, the process needs to implement and enforce the policies and procedures. You know, it's got to be, since it's automated, you can enforce the policies that you come up with. And if there's a need to bypass the policy, there has to be a way to do that and documentation on why you bypass the policy. And management of upgrades and patch releases. And, you know, some of these concepts may sound trivial. I think when we get into the commandments, you'll understand, you know, why I think they're so important to pull them out and talk about them explicitly. Okay, the first commandment, thou shalt use a source code control system. I think everything possible should be under source code control. Your source code, that's obvious, build files, your build tools, your documentation, your customer documentation, and your internal documentation, your build results, and possibly your build artifacts. Build artifacts or build by build results here, I mean build reports, possibly. You know, what were the results of the builds, what tests passed, and so forth. You might want to check those into your source code control system so that you've got a record of what happened with each build, change logs associated between build to build, you know, and the build artifacts. You might have binaries that you want to check into a source code control system for tracking purposes. Some companies use their source code repository to make code binaries and so forth readily available because someone can just check the file out and start using it right away. It's one way to use it. You don't have to. There's other ways to accomplish the same thing. And it doesn't matter what you use. Just use something. How many people here use Git? Subversion? CVS? Perforce? Anything else?
Bizarre.
Do what?
Bizarre.
Bizarre? What? I'm sorry? Really? Okay, Mercurial? What was that? I didn't. I'm not familiar. Okay. Aptera, is that?
Okay.
SCCS was the very first one I ever used, and that was a long time ago, and it was painful. So things have gotten better. I don't think it matters. We can spend the rest of the time discussing which source code control system we like and why. I don't think it matters what you use. I happen to prefer the open source one variety personally, but sometimes there's business decisions for going with something else. Related to this, you need to have a reproducible build environment. The following things, they're usually not checked into your source code repository because it's just not practical. SCRs weren't really designed to handle these kinds of things like your operating system. But you've got to be able to recreate, you have to understand which versions of your product you're going to have to support and what build environments you need to recreate those. This is one of my pet peeves because early on in my career, I worked for a software vendor and we were a young company, and one of our early releases, we could not recreate it for whatever reason. We had an engineer whose job was not, he was doing builds, but that wasn't his core job. And we just couldn't recreate it. And I kind of took note of that, and throughout my career, I'm like, okay, can we recreate this? Do we still need to support it? Excuse me. So some of the things you might want to, you have to be able to recreate is, the operating system, whether it's a physical machine or it's a virtual machine, you're going to have to be able to recreate that. Know what compilers are needed and what build tools. Very often you've got a combination of open source build tools and internally developed build tools, and you've got to make sure that you can recreate the whole build environment. And this is something you guys know. I mean, you all guys know how to do this. You know how to come up with solutions for being able to recreate environments. And for those of you who have internal development organization, you can work with them on helping them come up with solutions. The next commandment is, thou shalt use the right tool for the job. I've worked with one company where we used Make for everything, and another company where we used Ant for everything. And I didn't think either one of those worked very well because, C programmers and C++ programmers, they want to go into the directory they're working in and type Make. And Make has some valuable, and I use Make as an example. I know there's, because I have a lot of experience with Make and with Ant, so I will use those as examples. I know there's other tools out there. And, the dependency checking is so crucial. And you don't get, I couldn't believe we were building C code with Ant. That just made no sense to me. And I think Ant's great for Java. Maven's great for Java. There's other tools out there, too. So it's okay to have multiple tools. You're probably going to have some scripting languages, too, especially when it comes to doing packaging. I use a lot of Bash and Python to do packaging because you're going to have to. It doesn't make heavy shell scripts or shell code in make files and even Ant files can be really, really ugly. And sometimes it just makes sense to write a shell script to do something. Just so I'm saying it's okay to have multiple tools, but you also don't want to have unnecessary complexity. So, the right tool for the job, which is certainly the Unix way, one tool, one job, and mix and match as you see necessary and as makes sense. I'm going to get down pretty at a lower level here just because this is an area where I've done a lot of work and it's an area where I feel it's really important. Your build system you need to think about multiple architectures and OS versions up front. The last job I had, we were an appliance company. And we started out, with one box, one hardware configuration, one kernel version, and one version of Linux. Well, 6 months down the road, we came out with new hardware. And the way our build system was architected, it couldn't support that in the way we needed for it to be done. And so I ended up having to modify hundreds of make files to support that. And I was like, well, this is no fun, and I bet we're going to have to do this again in a few months, so let me see if I can make it easier next time. And so we did that with centralized files and also make definitions so that depending on the architecture or the flags we pass the build, we can build against different kernels and use different compiler options and so forth. And that seemed to work very well, and sure enough, 6 months later, we came out and I needed to support yet another version, and because I had already done this work, it only took me a few minutes instead of several days to do the work. Most developers, very few people are make experts or Ant experts, and so, most developers are experts in their programming language that they're working in, and like I said, the build tools, I think, are a necessary evil. And so providing templates that the developers can use because that buys you, not only does it make the developer get started easier, it makes supporting it much, much easier because now you have, make, for example, well, even Ant, both of those languages are very difficult to read. And if you have files at least that are structured the same way and have the same definition variables and so forth, and the same task names, it makes it much easier to support in the long run. And I guess you all have heard measure twice, cut once. I think you can apply that to this. If you have to edit a file once, like when I had to go through and edit all those make files, think about it and think, okay, what can I do to make this easier? So sit and think about it, and maybe you do some work now to leverage that later. And I think as system administrators, you all are aware of this because, we're, like I said earlier about task automation. If you have to do a task manually two or three times, probably time to start thinking about automating that task. So it's the same concept. Okay, so I'm going to talk about reproducibility a lot. Thou shalt use a build process that's reproducible. And it needs to be automated, needs to be unattended, and reproducible again, because I can't say that too many times. There needs to be some kind of continuous build policy. And it doesn't matter. There's lots of different ways. How many people here working environment where you have a continuous build? About half. And there, you know, there's lots of different ways you can have a continuous build. You can have one every time there's a check-in into the repository. You can have a time-paced build where every night you do a build or every 6 hours or whatever it is. You have to figure out what is the best policy for your environment. You also have different customers for a continuous build, which can make things a little bit tricky. In my experience, developers want a build kicked off as soon as they check something in. Well, if your build takes 6 hours, that's probably not practical because you've got lots of different engineers checking things in, and the queue would get built up so long that you would never get done. So you may need to batch things up. As a release engineer, I have my own criteria for a continuous build. I want one done as soon as possible, but I also I want it to never fail, too. And so you might have to do it. Sometimes time-based builds are good because all the engineers know, oh, I need to get all my check-ins done before this time, and I need to make sure that the build is good. The important thing is to have a policy, and then you can modify it based on your environment. And there's some great open-source tools out there. I've used Cruise Control a lot. I've used Hudson a little bit. And if I was starting today, I would probably use Hudson. And they help you with setting criteria for when to kick off a build, all the reporting of the build results, what to do with the build artifacts, being able to run tests afterwards. And so this whole thing is much easier than it used to be. 15 years ago, we had to write all of our own code to do all of this, and so it wasn't always practical. I talked about a build ID earlier. This is going to be some kind of string, probably. And it needs to provide enough information so the build can be identified and reproduced. Some examples of the type of information that would go into a build ID would be the date, the repository revision, the release version of the software, maybe the person doing the build. There's lots of different information. I've done this talk at Google a couple times in the past week, and the question I got asked both times was, can the build ID be a string that you use or a value you used into a lookup table? And yeah, sure, if that makes sense. But it needs to be easily obtainable. I think a lot of the information in the build ID needs to be in the packaging itself. So if you have a package, you can query it and find out some of this information. Because basically, what you're trying to ask is, what is this? And maybe it's embedded in binaries. Some of the projects I work on, we include this information in the binary, so you can do a dash V and get the information to see what's in the binary. So another scenario is a systems engineer out in the field working on a customer machine. I think this is becoming rarer and rarer, but it still happens. They're trying to figure out what's on the customer machine. And you certainly don't want to have to be logging onto the corporate machines doing a lookup into a database on the corporate machines to find out. So you really think about your use cases for your build ID. But the primary motivation is, what do I need to do to reproduce the build? Or at least as a release engineer, that's what I need from the build ID. Back. Okay, package managers. How many people here like package managers? How many people here hate package managers? Oh, good, yay. Okay, good, some discussion, I hope. How many people don't care? Oh, good. Okay, you're the right talk then. So I like package managers. I like package managers a lot. So I fall in the first show of hands. There are things you, the reason I do is because there's so many things you get for free with a package manager. You get auditing. There's, you know, installation, upgrade, and removal capabilities you can get. Most package managers have hooks in where you can just drop commands in to do these things. You don't have to write all of the supporting code around it. Database capabilities. That goes back to the auditing. You know, you want to be able to answer what's on my machine. And a package manager allows you to do that easily, I think. You get a manifest. And I'm, okay, you know, TAR-TF, you can get a manifest too. But, you know, there's manifest capabilities. What's in this package? Not only what's the build IT, what's the a version of the package and so forth, but exactly what is in this package. I like to use native package managers where possible. The last job I had, my build system ran on 13 different platforms every night, creating RPMs, Debian packages, Solaris packages, and MSI files, as well as we couldn't get away from TAR completely, so there were TAR files too. But I like to use native package managers, and one of the reasons is I can hand somebody an RPM and they know what to do with it. I don't have to provide a lot of supporting documentation with that. You get it built-in version tracking, the dependency checking. All the package managers have nice capabilities where you can say, okay, I need this version, and this version first. Of these other, you know, I need this version of this C compiler. and you get that for free with the package manager. When we get to the end, I'd like to find out from the people who don't like package managers why you don't like package managers, because I'm actually very interested in that. Because I'm sure you've got good reasons and possibly reasons I have not thought about that I'd like to know. Down here, TAR is not a package manager. TAR is very useful though. I like TAR. Thou shalt design an upgrade process before releasing version 1.0. There's decisions you can make. Well, there's decisions you can fail to make that will affect your ability to upgrade. I actually had this happen to me. We were using RPM. I've worked for several appliance companies. At one of the appliance companies I was working for, and if we came to the point where it was difficult to use RPM to do our upgrades because of decisions we had made in the RPMs. Spec files, basically. And it was my first experience working with packages, and I didn't realize that. If I'd really planned my upgrade process, if I'd only done this, my life would have been easier. And so you need to think about this. You need to think about what is going to be my upgrade process. And as one of my colleagues pointed out yesterday, what's my rollback process, too? What happens if the package install fails? There's things you can do in a downgrade process, I guess, or rollback process as well. I think you need to design an upgrade process at the same time. You know, you hope you're not only going to have version 1.0 of a product. You hope that the product's going to be around for a while and they're going to have many, many different versions. So think about that up front. Don't wait until, oh my God, you know, we need to send out a patch for this, or we need to send out the next version. And then you realize, oh man, you know, we're going to have to totally uninstall this product and reinstall a whole new version of it. So, think about it. How many people have installed software that just mysteriously installs and you don't know what it's done, and, you know, you hope it worked? And I think all software needs to provide a log of what it's doing. And there's many reasons for this. I think the reasons we as system administrators care is, what happens if it fails? I'm going to have to possibly manually either finish installing the software, manually uninstall it, because probably the uninstall process the vendor provides isn't going to work since my install was unsuccessful. Knowing exactly what is going on will help with troubleshooting. It will help you if you start having a problem on the machine with a different product, and you're like, okay, well, that was working yesterday. Oh, this updated my shared library, and now it's incompatible with the previous product. I didn't realize they had installed that. Being able to unpack and inspect the packages. Sometimes you want to do that. You want to see, you know, okay, what shared libraries are included with this? There's an installation script here. Let me look at it and see what it's going to do to see if there's any potential problems. It'd be nice if there was a do nothing option where it could just log what it would do and what it found. There's very few vendor products that do that, but you know it would be nice if they did. And you know there needs to be a complete life cycle of the product on the machine. You want to be able to install it. You want to be able to upgrade it. You want to be able to patch it. You want to be able to uninstall it. And it needs to be automated. You don't want to have to execute a bunch of different commands, edit a bunch of different files. And as I alluded to earlier, there needs to be a rollback and a roll forward. If there's a problem, if there's a problem doing an upgrade or a patch, the solution can't be, you have to uninstall the whole thing and then get back up to where you were before you started the upgrade or patch process. That's not a good answer. If your software is working and the vendor gives you a patch, you want to at least end up in the same spot you were before you began the patch. You don't want to regress or don't want to end up with just having to roll totally back. So there needs to be some kind of rollback process, and very few vendors think about that. They think about only, if it fails, they're going to give you a new patch to try, and you hope that's going to work, and you never can get back to where you were unless you go to your system backups and restore. And what happens if there was database schema changes, too? Then you've got a real mess on your hands unless the vendor provides you with rollback capabilities. Also, packages should be relocatable. I've seen cases, and at least one customer of mine, where even the sysadmins didn't have write access to some of the locations on the Unix file system. And so you want the ability to install your software in wherever it is the installer chooses to put it. And that has a lot of implications. It's not just the packaging. There's runtime issues there, too, as you all know, with being able to find shared libraries and so forth. And so my last slide, and I'll open it up for discussion, is I think a lot of these concepts, I told you my first love is system administration, and every time I run across things, I'm like, oh man, I wish I'd known about this, and I wish I'd thought about trying this. And I think a lot of these ideas can be applied to system administration, making changes to machines, installing open source software on machines, and so forth. At the end of the day, we want to be able to, support the machines and have the machines up and running. We don't want to spend a lot. If a machine goes down, we want to be able to quickly either get it back up again or get a replacement machine back up quickly. And so I think a lot of these concepts, apply to system administration and other disciplines, not just, software engineering. Because, I guess my thought is bits are bits. And release engineering is all about taking those bits and figuring out a reliable way of delivering them to where they need to go. And so questions, opinions. So someone who doesn't like package managers, I'd like to hear why. Or you go ahead if you're going to ask. There's a mic here and there's a mic there, so feel free to.
I'm Paul Krizak from AMD. What are your thoughts on some of the newer packaging systems? In particular, I'm thinking of RPath that takes the build process beyond just making binaries and actually builds the entire runtime from the operating system all the way to your application all in one shot. Do you think that's a direction that is moving in the right direction, or do you think that's overkill? What are your thoughts on that?
I think it depends on the environment that you're in. The last build system I wrote, it was for an appliance company, and I did that every night with my own software, and certainly having a tool that did that. I mean, we started writing it 4 years ago, and there wasn't anything on the market that really did that. It certainly could be overkill, but I certainly think there's a lot of applications where, situations where it would be beneficial.
Thanks.
So, thank you. Good question.
Yes. Matthew Barr from MarketServe. Two questions. First of all, are your slides going to be online?
They're nodding their head in the back.
Okay.
Yes. And I think the talk is online also,
right.
But the slides are probably more useful than the talk since you're here.
Second question. We actually don't have large binaries that we ship. In fact, we don't ship anything. It's just deploying them to web servers and app servers. We're actually having an argument internally as to whether or not RPMs or just deploy source files off of the build server, off of the via tools, make more sense. Not for compiled applications, but things like either PHP or Java code. Obviously, we go ahead and use RPMs for any kind of things like JDKs or any other system elements, but what are your thoughts in those areas in terms of, where the application is a series of files?
I think it's kind of what I'm alluding to here. I think packaging something up, basically a group of files that have something in common and labeling them can be useful. My first experience with RPM was source code. When you installed an RPM, it basically installed the source code on your machine and built the software. You didn't find a lot of you still don't find a lot of open source code that includes code to package the build results from the open source. I had to write a lot of those myself because we used I used a YAML server to recreate my appliance when I did my build. So all my RPMs, and if I wanted to use a different version of something, I packaged it into an RPM and put it on the YAML server, and when the build would pick it up automatically.
Right.
So did that answer your question?
Yeah.
So yes, I think using it doesn't have to be using packages for files, I think, is a good thing. It can be a good thing. Just like anything, though, you can over apply it. You have to look at the benefits versus the cost. So we'll just go back and forth between the mics. How's that?
So do you like auto tools?
I'm not familiar with auto tools.
So like .com/configure.
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay. And so, how do you deal with?
But there's usually no packaging associated with it.
Tried to package something that's built with auto tools?
Absolutely, I have. In fact, that's what I was alluding to. Was I would come up with a spec file and a script. At the end result, I would package it into an RPM.
Yeah. So did you do the ugly magic of putting variables in your .spec file so that AutoTools would update it so that when it found the various versions of libraries and such on the system, it would port those into the spec file so you could build it?
I did not do that because I was working in a controlled environment where I was building an appliance.
This is why I hate packaging.
Okay. That's... very good point. I like the way you did that. You came up with a technical You were trying to trick me, weren't you?
Yes. Did it work?
No, you have a good point. Like I said, it's not for...
So I support deployment from AS3 to EL5, and you might guess that things like the version of Python from AS3 to EL5 are not the same, minus the updates that have happened in EL5 for Python. And we build software that has Python includes, and packaging that is...
So how do you manage that? I mean, you've got to manage it, right? I mean, you're going to end
up
with the wrong bits.
So that's the problem. So AutoTools helps us a lot, but every time we try to make that into an RPM, the world kind of goes to hell in a handbasket.
Well, you end up with multiple build environments.
Yeah, so...
Which isn't always ideal either.
The solution ends up being like 25 RPMs, which for every release, which
can be ugly.
Kind of stupid,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah. So. Back, Mac.
Hi, I was curious, when you're deploying something like a web app to a machine, you know, that's various dependencies, do you recommend like installing those as the super user onto the full-on system or having a separate environment in a home directory or a ch root, or I'm just curious how that's...
I think the less you can do as root, the better. Does everybody agree with that? Okay. And this is where things like relocatable packages, you know, I can install it anywhere I want to and it's going to work. Debian has a capability to do that too, right? We were talking about that yesterday. So, I mean, you don't want to do things as root unless you have to. Unfortunately, on Unix machines, unless the application is relocatable, things like shared libraries have to go into either a set node of locations, or you've got to make changes to a system file to make it aware that, hey, there's shared libraries over here. So, that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, front mic.
Hi, Hal Snyder with Orbitz. And first I'd like to respond to the earlier comment about AutoConf compatibility, because at an earlier employer, I experienced considerable success with the compatibility between AutoConf tools and the BSD family of packaging systems, and the NetBSD package source system is actually portable across operating systems, including Solaris and Linux.
I had heard about that. I had heard that as well. And, you know, this, you know, I state these commandments, and I'm like, you know, you need to do this, but there's always exceptions, right? And that's what makes our job interesting, is all the exceptions. And I love native package managers, but if I can have a package manager that works everywhere and it buys me more, then particularly if I own the environment and I'm the one doing the installation, I can deal with the fact it's not a native package manager. So that's conflicting with something I said earlier, but that sounds like an excellent trade-off and an excellent reason for doing that.
Okay, but my question for you is, package managers in general apply to a single server. Are you aware of any packaging system that handles dependencies of configuration items across different servers and the orchestration of their installation?
No, I'm not. Are you? I want to download that. That sounds awesome. But basically, it's taking it to the whole environment.
But not at the full systems level, like a CF engine or a Puppet or
no,
such.
I'm not. If anybody else is, feel free to get up to the mic and tell us about it. That's a very interesting idea. Yes.
Adam Gray with Meebo. I was wondering what you do to attempt or actually do RPM downgrades.
RPM what?
Downgrades or rollbacks.
Well,
with dependencies.
If the person who created the RPM thought about that when they generated the RPM, it becomes easier. The thing is, what's going to happen when you do the RPM-E? You don't know what's going to happen unless you go in and look at the spec file. And so you know, I think your mileage may vary there. And that's why I think it's so important, if you are packaging software, you think about, you answer that question up front.
And have you ever dealt with cleaning up dependencies that you installed from a package that you no longer need? Other than just re-jumping, reinstalling
devices. Yeah, yeah. You know, sometimes you just have to force it, because it can get really ugly. You know that package is no longer there, but the package you're trying to uninstall thinks it's still there.
Well, or it's not even like the RPM database is out of sync or anything. It's, you installed a package, it pulled in dependencies that you no longer actually need. So, I mean, that usually
helps. Oh, I see
to
what
have,
you're saying. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I see what
like,
you're saying.
Sure, what your system is.
Well, I think once the package is already installed, you're okay in removing those. It's just what's going to happen when you try to do an upgrade. And you can certainly, there's options to RPM where you can tell it, I don't care, install anyway. And you can, yeah. So you can override those. And that's, I think that's an important feature. You want to be the ability to override and say, no, I understand enough about what's going on my machine that I want you to install anyway.
Okay.
So, any other questions? Okay, I only heard from one person who doesn't like package managers, and half of you raised your hands. Okay, he's frustrated with them because they're all different. Well, it sounds like BSD has a solution. Well, BSD runs on all the different platforms, more importantly. So here's a solution that, because it is frustrating. I mean, I don't like generating Solaris packages. I think it's a very difficult thing to do. It's a very powerful, but it certainly is not as easy as creating a Debian or an RPM. Debian package or an RPM, yes.
To the gentleman in the front row who just said we should all move to BSD, I would like to ask, which one?
Anybody else on the evils of package managers? Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.